hope you're doing well. My name is Anahita Sen, and I'm a co-facilitator of the M&A Stories YouTube podcast, which is brought to you by Fifth Chrome Business Insights. Welcome to Season 3. The theme of this season is culture and its impact on M&A integration. Culture is one of the biggest challenges that face an M&A integration. And this challenge couldn't get any bigger, as more companies are pursuing M&A based on people and culture. That is why it is important to understand, internalize, respect, and develop a clear plan of action on how to handle culture in M&A. In this season, we will be interviewing industry leaders from across the globe to hear their stories on how they address culture in an M&A integration. So here we go with today's episode.
Welcome, Alex. How's it been? And you're part of the world.
That's great. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I'm in Washington, D.C., so we're getting cold right now, and we're getting ready for the holidays, so it's really nice.
Awesome. Are you getting a lot of snow yet, or is that
none?
Still...
Not yet. That takes some time. Usually, that's a January, February event. But it is starting to get in the teens a little bit, which is it's nice. It's a good change.
Brilliant. Yeah, we've had some very cold days, although it's not snowed here as well, but our surrounding countries, they've had their fair share of snow. But looking forward to having some snow, hopefully during the holidays. But that's not the reason why we are here. We are here to talk about culture, especially in post-merger integrations in M&A, and how it impacts. But before we delve into the culture topic, why don't we start with a bit of an introduction, Alex?
Yeah, absolutely. After about a career in the Marine Corps, I spent in the U.S. Marine Corps, I pivoted over to corporate America to do M&A integration-like work, trying to make sure that we were integrating the companies appropriately. And so I've been doing that for a little bit over 8 years, off and on, with different types of deals, everything from asset sales to acquisitions, mergers, spinoffs, you name it. So it's been, to me, it's not only something that I've done here in corporate America, integrating people and integrating cultures, but also when I was in the Marine Corps, that's a lot of what I did as well. I had groups that I would bring into infantry units, and we would have to be a part of their culture. And they have a very different culture from what we had. And so we would have to work with them to try to facilitate airstrikes or medevacs or whatever it was. And then we pull out and go somewhere else. So it was a constant, always making sure we were not only integrating procedures, processes, and people, but also thinking very carefully about the culture that they have, the culture that we have, and how we were going to bring the two together.
I think that's a great example to get the conversation started, because literally a lot of us bring our own perspective on culture into the world of M&A from our prior experiences. So that's a great call out to get the conversation started. Now, let's talk about from an M&A perspective and culture, because this is one area where we've seen consistently that business leaders, senior leaders often struggle with it. While they understand that there is an element called culture, they understand what it may be, but how to manage culture can always or is sometimes a challenge for organizations. So what's been your experience so far around culture in M&A?
Look, I've made plenty of failures when it comes to integrating companies and culture. Right? That's probably, it's how I've come upon the realization of how important culture is. And you don't realize until you have something consistent, deal after deal after deal, and you realize, what is making all of this miss? Why aren't these being much more successful than what we had intended? And it comes right down to a lot of what you do in diligence and the respect that you have for this term culture, and what does it mean? And I've gone back and thought about it really long and hard after one of the last deals that I worked on. And this, what I really realized was that it's not about these things that people plaster on the walls, what their values are. And it's not about what the CEO or the founder says their company is all about, right? And it's not about some annual employee assessment that gets sent out, and then all of a sudden everyone has a rating of how good and bad we are in certain ways. But when we think about culture, it's so much more, what are the ways of working? how do people work on a day-to-day basis? And what are the common strains we can pull from that? And so I think what we also, what I've noticed is at the very top, a lot of times there's a lack of respect for the complexity of culture. They think that's an HR thing to deal with. And I would say, no. This is a leadership thing. This is not a HR thing. And we can't, many times we try to outsource all those fluffy things to HR when it's, no, this is your job as a leader. You have to think about your people and how you're going to bring them together. So it's a, I think many times it's a lack of respect for the complexities of culture. I think it's also a lot of times the miss is you've got deals being driven by corporate development. And corporate development, love them to death. Don't get me wrong. I'm not disparaging them at all whatsoever. They do amazing work, but they focus on the numbers, the deal. What risks exist that would blow up the deal getting done? Or what would exist that would make it so we have some InfoSec issue or some other major legal issue? These are the types of people that they know how to sprint from diligence to sign. And once it's done, they move on to the next deal. Then they hand it over to integration, and integration has to run with it in a way that, wait a second, there are so many things that really needed to get done here early on, but the focus was just, can we get the deal done? And there's a difference between the sprint of the deal and the marathon of the integration. And I think what we need to do is do a much better job of bringing the integration work into the diligence, specifically around culture. What is the cultural assessment? And asking questions that are fluffy. They're just, that's the way it is. We got to admit that's important.
Brilliant. I love some of the examples that you've talked about, some of the challenges that organizations face. So to make it interesting for our for the people who are watching the show or listening to the podcast, let's talk about a story from your own experience. Let's talk about maybe early part of your career, the first time you came across culture in M&A. What was that, and why did it, what led to that particular trigger point in your life?
Yeah, I'll paint a picture without naming names. That's okay.
Sure, of course.
A little anonymity goes a long way, I think. I was a $300 billion payments company going to acquire a e-commerce tools company. Sure. And, about $4 billion for it. And on the one side, you had this payments company that really believed in who they were, and that they were going to buy this company. They were going to do all these great things. And then there was a lack of self-awareness on the acquiring side. Who are we? Like, really, who are we? And then on the other side, it was a little bit of hubris, the people who were being acquired, because they were getting, it was a ridiculous premium. They were getting paid a crazy amount of money. And so a little hubris on their side. And so there was really not a sense of like, let's talk about all these ugly, sticky things before we close the deal. And the fear of killing the deal was paramount in people's minds, so that after and people made promises they couldn't keep, painted pictures that, were how we were going to, they were going to change the larger company's culture. It was kind of crazy. And so these promises that we made that we had no ability to keep, much less really any right to make, gave these people a sense on the other side of that they were going to be much more controlled than they were. And so when we signed it, and by the way, we didn't come up with a joint strategy together. The payments company, the acquiring, we knew what we wanted to do. Did we tell them? Not really. I mean, we hinted at it, but we didn't want to kill the deal. So when we sat down to tell them after signing and closed that this is what we were going to do, that was not their plan. That was our plan. There was nothing joint about it. And then all these promises that we made that we couldn't keep, you really broke the trust. And that's the hardest thing to do, is to build the trust. And we went out of the gate with tons of broken promises, zero trust. And then they had their culture, we had our culture, and we had an expectation that they were going to know that we were the dominant culture, and they felt like they had autonomy that we had no intention of keeping. So it was tricky. It was hard.
Right. So let's you know, that's a very, very interesting example that you're sharing with us. So help me understand a bit more about the original plans, right? So it's the pre-deal thesis when this 300 billion gorilla wanted to acquire this 3 billion, you know, not 3 billion, that was the price that was paid, but let's assume that it was about a billion, maybe billion and a half or whatever it was, a company. What was some of the thinking in the heads of the leaders of the acquiring company? What were they thinking of when they acquired this particular company from a strategy perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a strategic perspective, the goal here was to create was to bring on a tool and a capability for consumers and merchants that would make the payments company's business stickier, make it more attractive, and something that they would say, "Hey, look, I'm not just giving, I'm getting." And so the consumer was getting tools, the merchants were getting tools, everything, small businesses, the large businesses. And to build this would have taken us way too long. And so strategically, I think it was a really very smart move. It was really what we needed and really was going to be beneficial. I just think that what wasn't thought about is how do you bring the two together? The analogy I like to use to paint a picture again is, like, imagine an artist with his or her palette. They've got some red paint and some blue paint, and they squeeze a little red paint and a little blue paint, and they have it on their palette. And does that make purple? No, it will make purple, but it's going to take work. It's going to take time. You're going to have to tweak it a little more blue, a little more red. Is this what you really want? And so I think people just assume that integrating people is the same thing as, like, bringing cultures together. It's a shift from integrating people to inclusion of cultures and creating one culture rather than two, unless your goal is to have true autonomy of the separate company, which definitely is an integration strategy that I've been involved in with some companies. But you can't go in and say, you know, you have autonomy and then think you're going to bring the cultures together really like that. It doesn't happen like that.
Sure. And let's say purely from a structure perspective. So the acquiring company wants to get this tools company. But they would use their own sales channels to sort of deploy this tool. They would use probably their own distribution marketing channels, their partners, to do that selling and marketing. So essentially what you're looking at was kind of the technology and maybe the product guys in the other organizations, not really the sales and marketing and the business engine, right? I mean, will that be kind of an approximation of...
Yes. Thanks for bringing me back to the strategy part, because that was the original question. Yes, I think it was a combination of, they had their own sales team, right? So we wanted to figure out, where is the cross-sell? How can the payments company sell the e-commerce tools? How can the e-commerce tools leverage the payments? And bringing those two together, that was the initial kind of, how do you increase the revenue, right? But then the second part is, how do you get more consumers and to use these tools? So then you create that flywheel where you bring more consumers, attract more merchants attract more consumers, and all of a sudden you're driving more business, not just because you're doing a cross-sell, but because the combination of the two brings more value to both sides of the two-sided network.
Right. Okay. Now let's talk a bit about the cultural differences between the two companies. And I kind of assume that the sort of the large company here was probably focusing a lot more on the profitability side of things, on, you know, command and control approach in the way they would manage the organization, emphasis on getting productivity and efficiency and that kind of thing. Whereas this smaller company was probably more focused on growth, on revenue gen, maybe some focus on profitability, but largely focusing on gaining market share, a lot more entrepreneurial. What was the sort of cultural mix at that point in time in both these companies?
Yeah, I mean, the company being acquired was definitely not worried about net income. They never do. It's like, it's all about growth in revenue, growth in market share. That's really what they're after. That those expenses, those are wily things that really, you know, no one ever, you know, focuses on.
Right.
So they had a very scrappy culture, very founder. There were two co-founders, very driven by them. They really did garner a tremendous amount of respect and out of their people. And so, and they were extremely visionary, very smart and very visionary from a product perspective. They knew how to build amazing products and in a way that would really attract consumers and merchants to their tools that they were developing. So a tremendous amount of credit I give to them for really what they were able to create. And they truly believed in this, their ways of working, their culture, the scrappiness of that culture. On the other side, you have a very a larger payments company, understands compliance, understands the legal. When you get that large in the fintech space, you have to. That's when the regulators start to pay attention to you, right? So you get, there's a great chasm between the big fintechs and the little fintechs, because the midsize, they get scared away by the regulators and they sell themselves out to the big guys, or they just go extinct because they can't handle the increased scrutiny. So the larger company was much more focused on quarterly earnings, focused on making sure that we were following the law, compliance being looked at. You know, you have the marketing folks who come in, they want to make there's a consistency when it comes to brand, and that the brand of the larger company was the predominant one, and the acquired company needs to fit under it. So function by function, everybody had their way of doing it, right? They had their playbook, their checklist, if you will.
Sure.
And that's important when you get big, that you have a consistency and a view of how do you operate. And that maturity and that discipline wasn't necessarily there with the smaller and scrappier.
Sure. Now, did these two founders kind of stay on? Did they have like an earnout or something as part of the deal, or did they exit the moment the company was bought, acquired?
No, the plan was to have an earnout where they had to stay for 3 years. That was the part of the structure of the deal was that they were part of it. It was not walk away at all.
Sure. And I would assume that when these guys came in, they probably were onboarded at like a middle management level, because, you know, on one side they were the founders and the guys who were running this company. But typically what's seen is when large companies acquire that side of a small company, their guys, the top guys, tend to get embedded in sort of the middle management layer. I mean, that's middle management layer. It's not the line management, but I'm saying departmental heads, functional heads, you know, that kind of thing. Was it the case in this one as well?
Yes, exactly the case.
Right. Okay, cool. So it's really setting the context here. So what kind of triggered off the culture bomb here, right? I mean, what was the point when you guys figured out culturally it was not just a mismatch, but it's a problem that you need to deal with sooner than later?
Shortly after close, very shortly after close, we met at the headquarters of the acquiring company. And there was this meeting about talent acquisition. And we were talking about what was this target operating model. What were we going to do with the company, and how would we phase and sync in time the integration of the functional areas into the larger company? And you could tell by the look on their face, they were a little like surprised. They were just like, well, I kind of get it, but, you know, there's some things we don't like, specifically around talent acquisition. We want to retain our own talent acquisition. And so my initial reaction was, well, shoot, that's a non-starter. There's no way. And the executive sponsor was like, no problem, we'll make it happen. And I looked at someone at the table and I thought to myself, one, he can't make that promise. It's not his promise to make. And the second thing was like, there is no way that the head of HR is going to allow talent acquisition to exist outside the larger company. And so at that point in time, I thought, oh, shoot, we are going to be in trouble pretty soon, because that's a promise that just got made. That's a promise that's definitely going to get broken. They're not going to forget about that promise. And then as time went on, I learned more about some promises of autonomy and some promises of, and then we, then right after that meeting, we went into a larger meeting about what the vision and the strategy was. And so PayPal sat down, the acquiring company sat down and said, here's what we're doing, this is what we're thinking, but we want to get your ideas too. And there was just this wash look of from the acquired company thinking, well, I get it, but that's not how we were, that's not what got me excited about this deal.
Right.
And so you could just tell there was a mismatch in what that joint strategy was going to be. There was nothing joint about it.
Sure.
It was the acquiring company strategy. What we could tell was going to be different from the acquired company's strategy. And I don't even know if the acquired company really had that much of a deeply rooted strategy. I think they were just very excited about the gobs of money they just right. put into their pockets. And I would have been excited about it too. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But that was when I realized, okay, we are going to be in the thick of it pretty soon.
Gotcha. Picture the room for me. You know, who are the people who are involved from the acquiring company? Because the acquired company, you had the founders, but from the acquiring company, who are the people who are involved in that at that stage? Who are in the room at that stage?
You had the head of corporate development was there, or representatives, and the integration folks were there, certainly. Product, the part of the acquiring company that was going to snap in this acquired company, that was those people were represented. There were some other subsidiaries of the acquiring company that would be really important opportunities for channels. Some of the salespeople were there as well. So it wasn't a massive room of people, but I would say at any one time there was about 15 to 20 people around a very large table, either taking notes or contributing to the conversation.
Gotcha. So the C-level, the executives, you know, the C-suite was never in the room as such, right? Okay, gotcha.
Well, now that's just the C-suite of the acquiring
company, correct? They were never there.
Yeah, of course.
So the C-suite of the acquiring company was never in the room, and I'm not saying it's a good or bad. I'm just saying, just painting the picture there, right? Now, so what happened after that? So you started getting some of those mismatches early on, where the leaders of the acquired company had a different understanding or different perception on how this whole thing was going to unfold versus the acquiring company. So what happened, you know, and why did it become so interesting?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think at first we were having these discussions about what the joint strategy was going to be, there was some meeting of the minds and there was some direction. So I think we finally coalesced around what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. There was just some issues around the prioritization of that. And so, you know, every company has their roadmap, and any acquisition is going to disrupt at best the roadmap. And so that was where we started getting some clashes, is on one side or the other, there was not a commitment to dedicate space in the roadmap to what we wanted to build in the timing that we needed to build it in order to realize the value drivers as promised to the board of directors. So we had to work through a lot of that. But then you also, that was from a value driver's perspective. But then there was also this cultural and who we were going to be together and separate, and how separate and autonomous everything was going to be. And that's when we started to really have some run-ins with the leadership. And in an effort to deliver the messages that were not very popular, I was talking to them and I was explaining to them what we needed to do and how we needed to do it. And, hey, look, I don't know if that's really going to work. Trying to be as diplomatic as possible to keep the promises that were made, but also make sure they understood, well, you know, I don't know why they made that promise. It's just not going to happen. But here's how I mean, my effort was to try to coach them through how to work within this new large company. Your question, I think right before this was.
So we're just going to come to that coaching part because, So what happened with the head of HR, right? When he or she heard about the talent acquisition resistance coming in from the acquired company. So you know, if you could just paint the picture there.
Oh, it was the quickest no you could ever imagine in your life. I mean, that became the hard part, because the person who made the promise wasn't the one who had to deliver the message that the promise wasn't going to be kept.
Right.
So you have an SVP making a promise.
Right.
He tries to talk to the EVP, head of HR. She says, absolutely not. Who do you think delivers the message back?
The integration leader.
This guy, right? And so when I go and I tell them, like, this is not going to happen. I don't know why they made the promise. They shouldn't have. Here's how it works. Let me explain to you this new company you've just been a part of.
Right.
And your question earlier, like, they thought they were the CEO and they became middle management. They're not used to they say something happens, it happens. They're not used to this anymore.
Right.
They, you know, I'm giving them a message they don't like. What do you think they do? Most of us, what we do, what do? You escalate. They escalate the complaint to my boss or my boss's boss or my boss's boss's boss. And all of a sudden, you know, that's where you have this friction, and that's where you run into issues. And so I think that was how all of a sudden the communication and the trust breakdown between me and the founders started to break down, because they just went around me.
Right. Gotcha. Now, at that stage, were you looked as a peer, or were you looked as somebody more senior to the founders in the equation, or were you looked down as somebody who was doing a more coordination role and therefore sort of less importance in sort of the hierarchy of structures here?
Yeah, I mean, I would say definitely their rank, if you will,
Sure.
Was higher than mine. And so I think in the world of, you know, them as a VP and me as a senior director, they knew that they were higher ranking, but they certainly also couldn't tell me what to do. Right. So I had a very unique role where I was like, look, this is what you need to do. I mean, in essence, my words and my actions spoke for the EVP. And so if they didn't like what I was saying, that was where they realized, okay, we've got to escalate to a different, his boss, and go up the chain and work through this. And what they didn't realize was they weren't going to get what they wanted. What I was saying was pretty accurate about how this was going to work out. It's just that, I was willing to work with them and coach them through it, but the other folks were just going to give them the answers.
Gotcha. Coming back to the promise part, right? Because making promises is one of the more common sort of errors of judgment, I call them, that gets made in mergers and acquisitions during the honeymoon period. A lot of promises get made, a lot of things get said, and assurances given. On the hindsight, from a culture perspective, what went wrong?
The promises that were made were not kept. And so the trust, foundation of trust was destroyed.
Right.
So you didn't, all of a sudden, like, you had nothing then. Like, literally, if you don't have trust, you can't do anything. And you know, what that ended up doing was once the trust was gone, once they escalated, an escalation once or twice is okay.
Sure.
All you do is escalate.
Yeah. Then it becomes part of the process. Yeah.
Right. You're labeled as whiner, and all your escalations, as good as they may be,
right,
fall on deaf ears, because they're like, these guys again.
Sure.
And so then what ended up happening with this deal specifically, you had sometimes duplicity. Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll do that. Don't do that.
Yeah.
or if they tell you what to do, don't do it. Come to me and I'll tell you whether you really should do it or not. Like, that would happen. And then after that, then you had just, when people started to realize that they were getting in trouble for the duplicity.
Sure.
Then you had quiet quitting, where people, especially on the founder side, their attitude was, well, you know, I made my money. I gave up. This is just ridiculous. And so then everything's really started to break down and get destroyed because of that.
Right. Yeah, that. So what were some of the ramifications, like purely from a business perspective, what were some of the ramifications apart from, you know, you mentioned about breaking the trust, which meant essentially bypassing the approach that were, or the methods or the procedures that were put in place. But what were some of the other things that started bubbling up?
Yeah, I think, a lack of true alignment ahead of time on what the value drivers were, how you were going to accomplish them, what metrics you were going to track everybody to over time that said, yes, you were or you weren't achieving the value drivers that bring in the revenue, which is the ultimate promise you made to the board of directors. That wasn't there before the signing.
Sure.
And so when you want to bring people together to say, now we need to do it post-sign, post-close, you don't have people working in concert together. You don't have people agreeing on the fundamentals of how you're going to bring the businesses together and how you're going to measure success versus failure. So therefore, since you didn't have a plan,
right,
anybody can say whether there was success or a failure. And so there, and even if you did have this idea of what you wanted to build together, how you were going to get there was so much harder. Because right. No one trusted each other, and people just thought, well, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, or we're going to do it my way, or, you know, who cares what they say, because they broke promises before. And so you just don't have a conjoined effort that says, this is what we're going to do together. We're going to lock arms and jump off the cliff because this is what we believe. And collectively we live or die. There was no sense of that. And so you didn't really have, a North Star that folks were pointing toward.
Gotcha.
And then you get to a point, honestly, you get to a point where people look around, they see the ship sinking, and they jump for a lifeboat. And so
all
of a sudden, all your really good quality folks who really wanted to be a part of this deal are running.
I like that analogy. Yeah, I love that analogy. Right. Okay, cool. So now what happened after that? I mean, you know, the trust was broken. Escalations started happening. People started bypassing. Some of these people left the ship. How did it come back together? Or did it come back together?
I would say it did come back together. Many, I would say years later. I would say, yeah, I would put the category on years.
Right.
And it was definitely not at the $4 billion valuation.
Right.
All of the accretion that we gave away a tremendous amount of accretion in the deal. I would, you know, I think if you sat down, you looked at the numbers, truly, what did this meet the value that we paid for it? You'd have to shake your head and say, no way. Is it even on track? So the tools are still being used, still capability. They're in the company. The founders are gone. Many of the leadership would all left the acquired company before the earnout, right? I think there was, and it was, I don't know what happened and how they got paid out. If they got paid out, what they were supposed to, I wouldn't have been included in that kind of conversation. But, you know, I think that is the end result was that we didn't get what we should have
out of the
deal.
Right. Gotcha. Now, what were some of the mistakes people made from a cultural perspective?
It's a broad question. So let me just say, the biggest mistake that was made from a cultural perspective was truly not doing an assessment of what is their culture.
Right.
But it's also, it's incumbent upon the acquiring company not just to find out what is their culture, but you got to figure out what is your culture.
Your culture, correct.
These ways of working are embedded, right? And so, in a big, huge company, you want to say you have one culture, but you just don't, right?
Correct.
You just need to have enough self-awareness to say, we have the same value systems, but we've got pockets of different cultures, and that's okay.
Correct. Because, microcosms, yeah.
Yeah, the compliance people are naturally going to be different from my product people, from my sales people. And so, like, you got to understand, like, first and foremost, if you really want to know culture, you can't know someone else if you don't know yourself.
Right.
And so I think what has to happen is a true self-assessment of both sides, the acquiring company and the acquired company. And through that self-assessment, you really can sit down and say, who are we? Where are our strengths? Where are our weaknesses? Where are the risks and opportunities of bringing these two organizations together,
right,
and having a plan to mitigate the risks and take advantage of those opportunities? And so, and then once you have that, then you can start to show true empathy for the other side.
Correct.
You can know why they're acting the way they are, because
right,
you know yourself, they know themselves. And it's actually, it's proven through self-awareness, sure, you then have better empathy. And so
right,
I think really truly what you need to do is have the assessment, self-assessment, understand yourself, understand who you are. Then, and only then, can you really figure out how you're going to bring the two together, how yeah, you're going to take that, as at my previous analogy, the blue paint and the red paint, how are you going to bring them together? And
right,
make the right color of purple you really want to make.
Sure, sure. And you and I, we have spoken about this earlier, right? Culture is often an outcome, a manifestation of the underlying structures. Now, one of the common mistakes I see in the industry when large companies acquire smaller companies is that you know that they're going to be different. The structures are going to be different. They're, as you said, their style was a lot more scrappy than the big company, which was focused a lot more on compliance and other stuff, right? Were there structural pieces that were taken into consideration saying these are guys are going to be different on, let's say, the kind of management system they use, or that they're going to have different hierarchy, organizational hierarchy, or they may have a different way of handling innovation or rewards and recognition? Were any of those sort of structural elements looked upon and compared, or was it like, hey, you know what, this is functional integration, HR needs to sort of tuck in into our HR? What was the landscape then?
Yeah, the cultural assessment that was done, in my opinion, was a box checking exercise. You right? I mean, what they did was, they're like, these are our values, that's their values. How well do they align? This is how they align. Great, good news. That's not enough.
Correct.
Or what was their annual self their assessment of their company?
Right.
What did their people say that was good and bad about their company?
Right.
Oh, this is how great they are. It was how great they are. And so, but you never thought about, like, where's this? What? How are they fitting into me? What I've got?
I love that.
Understanding that, and that self assessment is, you know, that's really not truly how they work, right? We're talking about ways of working,
yeah,
which is different than how happy are you at work.
Correct. Exactly. Exactly.
And that wasn't the right way or the right tool to use for that self-assessment, for that understanding the culture.
Correct. I mean, this pulse surveys or employee satisfaction surveys, and I'm like, you ask about, do you like your manager or not? Does the manager give you the avenue of whatever, right? And I look at majority of the questions. So while they are to get a feel of how the employees behave, to get a feel of what's the work environment like. But when it comes to comparisons, right, career development opportunities, are you getting the right level of career development opportunities, right? So for a smaller company, if the guy says, yes, I'm getting it, and the larger company guy says, yes, I'm getting it, then you get a false alignment, because literally career development opportunities in the large companies are different from career development opportunities in a smaller company. So that's a very interesting thing. And I just love the example there. If you were to sort of go back and do it again, you talked about conducting assessments. What else would you do in order to have a good, seamless cultural integration?
I think what you need to do before signing, and I know this has become very controversial with the corporate development folks who are like, we got to keep this secret. We can't go to that level of detail, is to do that, to do the individual assessments of
right,
people. And I look, I, here's the way I would do it.
Right.
You go get an individual assessment, like say, you know, Discovery, Insights Discovery, or Colby, right, or some type of individual assessment.
Right.
And then you get everybody in the acquired, the company you're acquiring,
yeah,
to take this assessment. And
assessment,
look, I get it. And you do this before sign. And I understand, like, wait, we can't let the employees know that we're doing this, you know, as a part of an acquisition.
Right.
You don't. You can just say, hey, this is a part of our effort to try to do better professional development.
Right.
And correct, we want to know who you are and what makes you tick. There's no right or wrong answer. We correct, just want to know this so that we can be better leaders and managers of you and your work.
Yeah.
And then we take that information and we can look at it and say, what are they like as individuals? What are they then like as a team, as a function, as an enterprise?
Yes.
Where do they plot on this wheel so that we understand, like, what makes them tick? How are they? I can't tell you exactly what data I'm going to be able to pull from it, or information I can pull from the data, until I really see the data. But right, I know that I'm going to be able to pull something out of that, and some type of result. I will get an assessment of, like, this is who they are and what makes them tick. I know the legal department is very much like this, and their product company is very much like, our teams are like this. And through that process, we can really figure out who they are. And then we look at the company as the acquiring company. We will have already done that assessment. We already right, know who we are. And then we look at the product teams and how different or like they are.
Correct.
And then we do the same thing with the legal teams and all functional. And then we look at the enterprises, and that we can really get a better idea of, like, who are they?
Sure.
Who are these people and who are we? And then we can really assess where are the risks and where are the opportunities. And so that's how I would do that. I would do that in preliminary diligence. It would be one yep, of the first things I would do.
Yeah.
As all of the functional areas are doing their dives into InfoSec issues, legal issues, HR issues, what are all those things that can creep up and bite you?
But yeah,
you can do all this other stuff at the same time. And then also, I think it's important to sit down and talk about, what are the promises?
Yeah.
What promises, who has made what promises, and should they have made those promises, and can we keep those promises?
Right.
And I think both sides really should know what promises were made.
Sure.
And then we sign a prenup. We yeah, have a really good sense
yeah,
of,
exactly,
like, hey, like, this is what we all said we were going to do together. And
right,
this is what you're giving up. Just so you know, you're not going to have autonomy. Just so you know, we already have a CEO, and you're not going to be CEO anymore. That right, means a loss of control.
Yes.
Are you okay with that? That big chunk of change you just put into your bank account, that you just sold some of the autonomy. You don't get to keep everything you
correct,
had status quo, but also get to put a big chunk of money in your pocket. That's very naive to think that that's going to be the way it's going to happen. And so I just think you need to have a good understanding of the risks and issues of culture. You
yep,
need to have a very good understanding of what promises were made, what are the prenups, what is the targeting, what is the target operating model going to be? In
yep,
5 years, what will your company look like? And thirdly, just a good sense of, what are we doing? What are we building together? What does that joint vision look like? What does that vision mean in terms of the strategy, in terms of product development? Do you both commit to giving up that much space on your roadmap to deliver on that? People think I'm crazy when I say that needs to happen pre-sign, but I'm like, guys, that's where the money is made. That's yes, where the value is.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, a lovely call out. And I love the Colby example, because psychometric, team dynamics, metrics, you know, become so important. So I love that call out, but I like the way you kind of summarized it, right? Now, since then, I know I was looking at the clock, you know, when you have good discussions, time just flies, but...
I got like, plenty of time. You keep going.
Right. Since then, what are some of the common mistakes that you have seen, and they continue to sort of keep coming back, integrations after integrations, transaction after transaction? What are some of the common mistakes with respect to culture?
I think it's just a sense of Peter Drucker was the one who said, culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Correct. Right?
And Peter Drucker, I mean, if you're a C-suite executive, you absolutely genuflect to the altar of Peter Drucker. You can't not do right. But yet they don't really have the same respect for culture and the complexities of it. And so I think that's really straight from the heart of it. It's just a respect for what culture is, and that it's not an HR fluffy thing.
Yeah.
It's a leadership thing. But one thing I noticed, and you know, as I mentioned earlier, I spent a career in the Marine Corps, is and honestly, I don't think you get a stronger culture than that the Marine Corps. And no matter, no apologies. If you don't fit into this culture, leave. And they, you know, you know what you're getting into when you join. And when you decide to stay, you know you're staying for that culture. Otherwise, you get the heck out.
Right.
But this idea of leadership is really ingrained in Marines and that culture, and the importance of what it means to lead people. And I think what happens a lot of time in corporate America is they just assume that leadership comes with tenure, and that if you're good at your skill set, if you're smart and good at your skill set of building a product or whatever it may be, that you're naturally going to be a good leader and leading people. Right. And that couldn't be further from the truth. And so what ends up happening is people get promoted based on their skills ability, and it's just assumed that they're going to be able to lead people to do it. And what you end up getting is a bunch of really bad leaders because they don't know how to lead, and the companies don't teach them or hold them accountable to good leadership principles and practices. And so I think what you need to do is you need to make sure that you have really well-trained leaders who understand that culture and inclusion of culture and integrating people is actually part of their job. It's not HR's job. It's their job.
Right. I think the Armed Forces example is, the Marine example is a absolutely brilliant one. And also Peter Drucker's culture eats strategy for breakfast. All of us would not even dispute this phrase, which is great companies have great culture, right? And yet when it comes to culture being an important part, or if not the most important part of a transaction, somehow gets overlooked. And part of that is probably because of lack of awareness of the ramifications of culture. Culture is looked upon as an HR topic that you'd mentioned. What are the ways that people can upskill themselves on understanding culture and understanding the ramifications? Are there books, websites, podcasts, or other things that people can listen up to and participate? Do you have some recommendations there?
I mean, actually, but probably top of my list, Primal Leadership by Boisatis McKee, and I can't remember the name of the last guy. But you know, that's all about EQ. What is this stuff called self-assessment or self-awareness, empathy? What are the things that drive successful leaders to be that, you know, level five leader? I think it's really important that people start to really understand, what is this? Why do people keep talking about EQ? What truly is it? And to be a student of leadership and culture is important. See, other books that I would say are important to me that I think that are good. Let's take, I've recently gone back to some of my philosophy courses. So, you know, Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, some real gems in there. I mean, just you wonder, how has this book been around for 2000 years? I mean, it's been around that long because there are some true gems in there. And, you know, if you know anything about Meditation by Marcus Aurelius, you know, it's actually it's a book to himself.
Sure.
This is his journal, his diary, but but the idea that it's been kept for us and we can use it ourselves and realize all what he was going through. And he's one of the best emperors of Rome. And you realize, wow, this guy had some serious issues and had to remind himself to be a good person. It's another great one.
Awesome.
Good to Great by Jim Collins.
Yeah.
That's more of a, what does it take to go from good to great? What are some of the what have leaders and leader, what have companies done to really make companies go from just B minus to A plus? And exactly. I think there's really great examples, like data points for people to look at as examples.
Brilliant, brilliant. And for the listeners and viewers, we're going to put all the description of the books in the show notes so that you can look it up. Brilliant. Couple of very quick sort of rapid fire questions, if you're up for it.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, cool. What posturing do you hate the most from senior leadership during M&A or transformation projects?
Well, I think, you know, I said it was promises, you know, making promises you can't and won't keep. That's a big one. And then, you know, I think it's, you know, a lot of times senior leaders will get into the room with the CEO and say, yeah, we think we should buy this company. And then they don't feel accountability to make sure it gets done.
Right.
You earlier said, yeah, C-suite wasn't in the room. We sat down and talked about the joint strategy. Well, that's a mistake, because someone's going to need to make space on the roadmap. And how do you make space on the roadmap? You can either hire people, but usually you got to say no to some stuff.
Sure.
What are you saying no to? And those people are going to squeal when you delay their project that they thought they were doing before you acquired this company. People need to be, you know, own and be accountable. Seek to be held accountable for the success of the deal. Yeah, I think we should do this rubber stamp, run away and say, whoa, I can't do that.
Sure.
You said you could. It's important.
Brilliant, brilliant. What behaviors would you encourage amongst teams participating in cultural integration during M&A?
You got to give a little to reach an alignment. You really do. You have to realize that, you know, your way is not going to be the way. We had to figure out how are we going to get there and how do we pace the activities and the changes that we're going to be insisting upon on the company that's getting acquired. It can't all happen at once and it can't all happen your way. And so you need to understand and have a little bit of empathy for what they're going through and how do you get them through this in a way that doesn't, you know, result in things like quiet quitting, duplicity, you know, escalations, et cetera.
Gotcha, gotcha. Great call out. What's that one condition that you think is completely non-negotiable in cultural integration in M&A?
The early and joint assessment of what are the value drivers, what's the culture, what are we doing together, before time. Absolutely, gotcha. Before time.
Gotcha. Brilliant, brilliant. And one sort of final question. Imagine yourself 15 years back, or whenever you started your M&A career. And if you were to give a piece of advice to your 15-year self back, what would that be regarding cultural integration in M&A?
Don't be afraid to break some glass.
Right.
That's how truly, I mean, boldness to bring about creative solutions is going to require you to charter a course where no one has ever gone before. And that's naturally what you're going to do when you do that. And you chart a course where people haven't been before. You are going to you're going to break some glass.
Sure.
And that's necessary in order for you to reap all of the sweet rewards that are associated with taking that risk and breaking some glass. So we're going to make mistakes. Bold actions naturally are going to bring about some mistakes, but that's the only way to bring about real and lasting change. And so I would say to people, not only should you not be afraid to break some glass, but don't encourage your people to break some glass and don't punish them when they do. And just create a culture of, hey, were your intentions in the right place? Did you learn anything when you broke some glass? Shoot, you may actually break some glass and it's not a mistake. You just, wow, I'm glad I broke that glass because I just opened a whole new aperture for how we're going to get more accomplished and create really great and lasting value.
Awesome, awesome. And I think that's an absolutely brilliant way to sort of bring this episode to wrap. Loved it. Lots of learning. I love the examples. I love the analogy. Alex, it was a pleasure to have you in our show today. Thank you so much.
I had a great time. I really appreciate it. Anytime.
Brilliant. I hope you guys enjoyed the show today. This show was sponsored by Fifth Chrome, a business strategy advisor and a training company specializing in M&A, post-merger integration, and business strategy.
Did you like today's content? If yes, then don't forget to hit the like button. If you heard something interesting, then don't forget to share it with your network and friends. And last but not least, please support us on this journey to spread awareness on topics related to M&A and integration by subscribing to our channel. That's all for now. Stay healthy and see you next time.
And if you like this episode, I'm sure you'll also like our latest new tool. It has a quick assessment scorecard to assess the robustness of your M&A integration design. It just takes less than 5 minutes to answer. It is for free and you can get instantaneous recommendation. So visit maintegrationplan.scoreapp.com and find out for yourself.